This is an ABC podcast.
This is ABC Australia Wide on ABC Radio.
We ended up with 9 students who graduated. 2 of them moved away from the area, which was unfortunate, but the other 7 were all then employed in aged care. And it was so successful that we decided we would do it again this year.
On the day the Aged Care Royal Commission hearings start in Darwin, we head to South Australia to look at a unique scheme that's delivering newly trained aged care workers into the sector. And happily going back to the Dark Ages, we go medieval in northern New South Wales.
Sword-wise, I've just got a typical Viking sword, just a flat blade, gouge in the middle, typical round pommel and a hilt, and it's good, does the job.
I'm Alex Hyman, this is Australia Wide. But first, on tonight's Four Corners, the Murray-Darling Basin Plan is described as a national disgrace, a rort and pink bats for farmers. 2 years on from its investigation into water theft in the Murray-Darling Basin that led to a royal commission, Four Corners returns to the river system to investigate new concerns about how the plan to rescue it is being carried out and at what cost to taxpayers. Sean Rubenstein Dunlop has tonight's story. Sean, the Murray-Darling hasn't been far from the news in the last 2 years. We've had the fish kills making headlines and, of course, the Royal Commission with its findings handed down earlier this year. Why is Four Corners returning to the Murray-Darling?
Look, the Royal Commission into the Murray-Darling Basin, which was run out of South Australia, was blocked by the federal government from questioning Commonwealth employees. And yet it found that much of the Murray-Darling Basin plan was marred by a serious lack of accountability and transparency. In particular, it drew in a particular scheme for that criticism, the water infrastructure scheme, which I'll tell you about in a moment, and basically highlighted that billions of dollars in taxpayer money had been spent and no one knows where the money's gone. Well, that's catnip to a journalist, and we decided to try to find the answers, try to find out where these billions of dollars in taxpayer spending have gone. The water infrastructure scheme is the centrepiece of the Murray-Darling Basin plan, and essentially it works like this. Farmers are given grants to pay for infrastructure to save water on their farms. So they're given grants to pay for irrigation systems, earthworks, even new dams to cut down water going to waste, to make their farms more productive as well. And in return, they give up a portion of their water rights. The idea is that they are saving water. But what we've discovered is that, in fact, this scheme is enabling farmers and farming businesses to use more water, to increase their irrigated land and to transition to crops which are far thirstier, like cotton and nuts, and which are putting the Murray-Darling River's water supply under strain. What we've also discovered is that tens of millions of dollars in these government subsidies are going to big business. They're going to huge corporations, many of them partly foreign-owned, and they're paying for big corporate expansions. They're paying for an expansion in irrigation. One of the cases we've looked at is the case of Webster Limited. That's an agri-giant in Australia. It produces, among other things, nuts and cotton. If you've eaten a walnut, you've probably eaten a Webster walnut. They produce 90% of Australia's walnuts, as well as a huge proportion of our walnut exports. Now, they've received $41 million from the taxpayer to carry out a massive expansion, to build dams to store tens of billions of litres of water that would have otherwise flowed past its properties and stayed in the Murray-Darling Basin, flowing through other communities and habitats. It's increased irrigable land by about 80 square kilometres, I should say, to create prime irrigable cotton country. And our former government insiders, scientists and other experts are telling us that this, among other projects, is putting extraordinary strain on the river system, all with the help of the taxpayer under a scheme that's designed to save the river system.
One of the voices we hear in tonight's episode is that of Paul Pierotti. He is the president of the Griffith Business Chamber. He gives a rather scathing assessment of the Murray-Darling Basin Plan.
The Murray-Darling Basin Plan is a trip and bottom line fail. It's failed for communities, it's failed for the economy, and it's absolutely failed for the environment. It has been the biggest waste of $13 billion in the history of Australia's economy.
Is that a widely held view along the Murray-Darling, Sean?
It's a widely held view among many farmers. It's a widely held view at this point among former government insiders and scientists and economists who've spent years analysing this scheme. The reviews are not good for the Murray-Darling Basin Plan at this point. All of those that I've mentioned agree that there are no signs that it's returning the amount of water to the rivers that we've been promised. No clear evidence, I should say. The government and the Murray-Darling Basin Authority would say that they have recovered thousands of billions of litres of in water entitlements to go back to the river system, buying them back from farmers, for example, and recovering those entitlements through this water infrastructure scheme as well. But those we've spoken to have told us that the government just isn't checking whether schemes like the water infrastructure scheme are actually saving water at all or having a detrimental effect on the river system. So, according to them, the science just isn't there.
What feedback have you had from the Murray-Darling Basin Authority about tonight's Four Corners episode?
We're yet to hear back from the Murray-Darling Basin Authority about this episode, but we've certainly had feedback from irrigators, lobby groups who are concerned that we are painting irrigators in a bad light and slandering the industry. I hope they can watch tonight, because we hear from a lot of farmers themselves who have benefited from this scheme and yet who are highly critical of the way it's functioning.
Cash Splash, reported by Sean Rubenstein Dunlop, airs tonight on ABC TV at 8:30. Sean, thank you for joining Australia Wide.
Pleasure.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide on ABC Radio.
With me, Alex Hyman, great to have your company. We know the dairy industry has had a tough time in recent years. Many farmers have walked away from the business and others are thinking about following. But are we seeing a shift to better times, at least for Victorian dairy farmers? And are things any better for dairy farmers over the border in New South Wales? The Victorian Winter Fair is an annual gathering of dairy farmers to show their best heifers and catch up with old friends, and it's just wrapped up in Bendigo. Sian Gard went along yesterday and spoke with a couple of exhibiting farmers, beginning with Murray Paulson from Taree in northern New South Wales.
Certainly has been pretty tough up home. There's been parts of it that have people that have got a bit of a break through the season, but we just need some better rains and better seasons ahead to try and get farmers a bit more confidence and help out the hip pocket by not having to pay out so much in grain costs and hay costs, and really to give everyone a bit of a chance, because the milk price has actually started to come up a little bit, but at the moment with the way the grain and hay price is, you don't really get to see the return from the extra income from your milk.
What would you like for those people that they're pouring milk in their coffee, over their cereal, baking their cakes with it? It's part of the everyday consumption of Australian households. What would you like them to understand so that they can support dairy farmers in Australia?
The biggest thing for us is just probably buy branded products, like the milk war between the major supermarkets and process and the like. That's really been one of the biggest issues for us moving forward since, I guess, back in 2011 when the dollar litre milk come in. And I guess the best way moving forward would be for everyday public, just like myself, to go out and buy your branded products, buy what's local to you if you've got a local company, buy the major brands that have been around for a long time, and go out and talk to a dairy farmer if you have the ability to, and talk to them and see what affects them, and try to stay away from the home brand stuff.
Ben Govett, dairy farmer, Northern Victoria, Dingy. Probably been pretty tough. The last 12 months has been particularly tough with drought sort of ongoing and feed costs.
How's everyone feeling?
I think probably in the last month, just speaking with people particularly locally and around, I think the positivity levels definitely improved. I think it's probably as low as it's ever been. Up the last 6 months has been pretty bad, but I think everyone's can see light at the end of the tunnel. Obviously milk prices have come out quite strong and quite positive. Everyone that's still in the industry is hoping for a good season and hopefully a bit of return to profitability.
Because there is a little bit of optimism, you're feeling more optimistic about the future that you've got planned out for you?
Still a little bit tentative long term. I mean, this year's with the way milk pricing has been and the way things have been for, say, the last decade, just a little bit tentative there.
What do you think needs to change on a political level so that dairy farmers in Australia have a sustainable long-term future in the industry?
Oh, I think we just need a little bit more protection from some of the rising costs that we have. I think most agricultural producers are probably a little bit the same. Costs are rising faster than commodity prices. We're facing battles in the consumer end. Supermarkets want to buy the food or sell the food for less than it's ever been sold. Australian-grown stuff seems to be used as the bottom of the cost chain sort of thing.
What else do you think Australians can do to educate themselves around supporting dairy farmers?
I think not just dairy farmers, I think just all farmers in general. I think there's a big push now. People are more interested in where their food comes from. The majority of the population is probably more wealthy than they ever have been and do care more about where their food comes from. A lot aren't just interested in cheap food anymore. In the last 5 years, change in attitudes towards agriculture is a positive one. I'd like to thank the people that are supporting the dairy industry and agriculture in general. There is a lot more positivity around agriculture than there probably has been since I started in farming. So we continue. It is good to get the support of the people we feed.
That's Dingy-based dairy farmer Ben Govett speaking with Sian Gard at the Victorian Winter Fair.
ABC Australia Wide.
If you listen really, really hard to the wind that's blowing, you can hear the voices and there's a peace come over you.
On ABC Radio.
To aged care now. They're not doctors or nurses, but they do important work in the aged care sector. Direct care attendants are the backbone of the aged care workforce, yet attracting people to these positions can be a challenge. The small town of Loxton in regional South Australia has tackled the problem with a new unique solution, offering scholarships to train locals for free to care for its ageing population. And it's working. Catherine Hertzenroder has this report.
Have you had your breakfast this morning, Hazel?
Just on there.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Was it nice?
Very nice.
Oh, good. What did you have for breakfast?
Carly Thompson is a direct care attendant. She's one of nearly a quarter of a million direct care workers in aged care in Australia. These workers are responsible for everything from helping residents to shower to lifting their spirits with a chat, and they can make a real difference.
One of my main reasons for studying was my nan had dementia and she unfortunately passed away, but to see her in a nursing home, and I was very thankful for the staff that were there with her and that had spent time with her when we couldn't, and just the staff always reminding them about us, and yeah, it's just really nice.
Direct care attendants are in high demand as the population ages, yet low pay and status perceptions are among barriers to recruiting staff. The community of Loxton in regional South Australia is tackling the problem with a unique initiative. It's offering scholarships for locals like Miss Thompson to receive training at its hospital and aged care facility. Sally Good is the presiding member of Loxton's Health Advisory Council.
Well, it's all very exciting. The HAC, the Health Advisory Council, decided 2 years ago that we would invest some of our community's money, which is donated to us so generously, into education. And we set up a partnership with a registered training organisation from Adelaide called Equals, and they train local residents to become Certificate 3 personal support attendants. And we do the training here at the hospital. So they have their theory in the boardroom, and then their clinical placement is in aged care. As far as we're aware, it's unique, certainly in South Australia. When we did it for the first time last year, it was sort of fingers crossed. We didn't really know quite what was going to happen. But Country Health SA were thrilled with it. And at the end of it, of course, we ended up with 9 students who graduated. Two of them moved away from the area, which was unfortunate, but the other seven were all then employed in aged care. So it brought us new personal support carers, and it was so successful that we decided we would do it again this year, and it's just started again.
There is currently no minimum training requirements for people wanting to work as direct care attendants in aged care. By offering free training, Loxton is not only guaranteeing a qualified workforce for its elderly residents, it's sending a message that direct care workers are valued in the community. Loxton Hospital Director of Nursing and Midwifery, Meredy Seaboth.
I think that's a really important message to take home. The community of Loxton, you know, feel that this role is very important, and so therefore they're offering these scholarships to help support staff, you know, students undertake these courses.
It's cost Loxton about $7,000 plus administrative and volunteer hours to run the program to date, because the bulk of the $2,000 training cost per participant is covered by a state government subsidy. This year, hospital cook and cleaner Stacey Hardman is completing the training.
So back in England, I was childcare related, so I've always enjoyed giving something back to the community and helping people learn things and helping them keep their skills for as long as they can. So here I've decided to try with the elderly, which while doing the cleaning role, I've been meeting some of the residents and doing things with them anyway, so they're always asking for help or just for a little chat and just keeping their life skills. Now I get to have a conversation with the locals, finding out about what they've done in their past. They want to know about my past and where I'm from. As soon as they hear the accent, it's like, oh, where are you from? So yeah, it is great having that social side with them.
That report from Catherine Hertzenroder.
One of the questions was, Dean, do you remember when Grandad tipped the backhoe over out at the ball?
ABC Australia Wide.
And it was like, bzz, bzz. I thought, okie doke, that thing works.
On ABC Radio.
That's right, you're on Australia Wide with me, Alex Hyman. Wolf Creek Crater is a spectacular hole in the ground south of Halls Creek in the Kimberley. For many, it's probably best known as the setting of the cult horror film of the same name. Western Science tells us Wolf Creek Crater formed by a meteorite hitting Earth. But for local Aboriginal people, the huge crater is an important part of their belief system. The Jaru people. And Jaru woman Katie Darkey told Erin Park more about the special site.
In Gadia world, they call it the meteorite fell down from the sky to the crater, and that's in Gadia world. But Aboriginal people in our country, when they was living there for many, many years, they said it's a rainbow serpent would fell in the crater, and that's the dreaming of our people, and that's why it's called Gandhimalan, because it doesn't grow any potatoes, bush potatoes, because it say no potato, no Gandhi.
So did you grow up sort of visiting?
Yeah, me and my family, my cousin Sylvia and Diane, we always go around to the crater and take the kids down there, and we visit more often, and then we go hunting to Sturt Creek. Sometimes we go fishing, and there's another massacre site at the Sturt Creek as well.
How special is that place?
Well, it's really special to our people. For many, many years, people used to lived there, and they were telling a story that one old man went hunting down from Sturt Creek through the river. There's a little billabong there not far from Sturt Creek, and he was hunting birds with his dingo, and then he heard these birds singing out on the other side, but he didn't know where he was going. Then he seen when he came up on the other side, he came out through the Wolf Creek Crater, and all the people said in the old days there's a tunnel runs from there to Sturt Creek. Yeah, we still carry it on, and we still talk to our kids so they can talk to their kids, and you know, we still carry the stories from our grandfathers and their grandfathers.
That's Katie Darkey speaking to Erin Park at Wolf Creek Crater in the East Kimberley. And finally tonight, in the age of technology, it can seem like there's no end to the beeps and buzzers from all the gadgets vying for our attention. So it's no wonder a growing number of people are choosing to go back to the Dark Ages. Leah White caught up with a few of them at a recent Viking village solstice on the New South Wales north coast.
Through the gates and you'll find no trace of technology, just a bustling village of medieval Vikings going about their daily lives like it was 1000 AD.
Back in the Dark Ages, 1000 years ago, food and textiles were a major part of the industry, a bit like the tech industry today. It's what everyone did, and you had to, in a way, even be quite wealthy to even buy clothes. So most people made their own clothes, which means you had to produce your own fibre. And so that really appeals to me, and that's what I'm really involved with.
For organiser Jenny Creasy, the love affair with all things medieval was born out of curiosity.
Like most people here today, I came along to a medieval fair, and I met some people particularly doing dyeing, because I was really into natural dyes, and I just really loved the costumes and the atmosphere that was set. And I went down to a few trainings and I just fell in love with the whole idea of letting go of modern life and slowing down and creating things from scratch. And I always love being more in touch with nature, and this really is another way to do that, so I really love that.
Hi, I'm Jim. I'm a Jarl of Rognvald's Lith. I guess my Viking name is Grim Wormskegg. Wormskegg means serpent beard. Yeah, I've been running this club since 2003, so that's when we formed. I've been playing the game since 1998, so 21 years. As far as the movement goes, from when I started, yeah, it's grown massively. You know, when we started back in 2003, I think I had three members that were keen to come and play along. And within a couple of years, you know, we've grown to 15 or so, and now we're up to about 60. So that's just in our group alone, you know. So there's actually about 120, 130 reenactors here this weekend. And they're just from different clubs from around the country, from Armidale, Coffs Harbour. We've got people from Sunshine Coast, inland, Brisbane, you know, things like that. So, it certainly has grown.
Lismore reenactment group Rognvald's Lith hold a Viking village every winter solstice in the town's CBD. The annual event attracts weavers, welders, warriors and woodworkers, to name a few, from across New South Wales and southeast Queensland. The Northern Rivers group is just one of many to have seen a surge in popularity.
I think there's a lot of it, it does have to do with shows like Game of Thrones and Vikings and things like that. Well, I guess it probably, ignites that initial spark of people to be interested and whatnot. And then when they come down here and see what we do, and we're like, we don't do any fantasy stuff. It's all based on history and how the old boys used to do it.
Whether it's the pull of popular historical TV dramas or the reward of ditching technology for the peace and tranquility of a simpler time, there's no doubt the battle reenactment side of things has been a big draw card.
Hi, I'm Lachlan and I'm from the NEMIS group, so that's New England Medieval Art Society, so we're based in Armidale. We're here for the Viking Village Solstice, which is held by Lith. Armour-wise, this is a leather lamellar, so this is a little intricate piece together leather that will stop a lot of slashes and blows, but pure stab might go through it, like if someone stabs straight through it, but it's going to save you from getting cleaved in half, so that's that. Helmet-wise, this is an Anglo-Saxon helmet. It's been a bit interpreted from the finds where it's from, just with the bits hanging off the back of it, but the Anglo-Saxons had some pretty blinged-up helmets, so we get to put a bit of copper and brass on all of it and make it all shiny and nice. Sword-wise, I've just got a typical Viking sword, just a flat blade, gouge in the middle, typical round pommel and a hilt, and it's good. Does the job. Now that we've got sort of forges and armories in Australia, it's a lot easier for us to get kit here. And now that we can get our own stuff in Australia and it's a bit cheaper, more accessible to us, it's become a lot bigger. It's growing a lot. Oh, you kind of step outside of your normal modern day type deal, especially events like this where you're all camping out together in the set up all your tents, you have the spit behind me, and it's all just it's the real environment of it. You just it's like taking a step back in time, and you just enjoy it for what it is. Technology wise, it's like you see around us, we haven't got, there's not a phone in sight and things like that. So, you know, it's just people trying to be in the moment.
That was medieval reenactor Lachlan Bishop ending that report by Leah White. And that's Australia Wide for this Monday. I'll be back again tomorrow. I'm Alex Hyman. Have a great night.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.